As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective Podcast. I'm Ted Berg, joined on the line, as always, by The Athletic's Mets beat writer, Tim Britton. Tim, can we just start the regular season?
It is that point of spring training where even the players are like, yeah, like, I got my work in. I don't need to do more work.
What are we doing? Like, I'm so sick of saying, like, oh, you know, like, this guy looks good. Oh, maybe that's how the bullpen will shake out. Like, just, I want to see how the bullpen shakes out. I don't want to think about how the bullpen shakes out anymore. I want to see it. I want to see it start happening. Enough of this. It's beautiful outside New York. It's baseball weather. I am sitting in the empty apartment next to my own, reconditioning my gloves for my old man scrub hardball season. I'm ready for the baseball to start, the real meaningful baseball. And you're telling me it's not time yet.
We got one more week to go. One more week of the Mets having Grapefruit League games that they like might not want to throw their best pitchers in because you don't want Jacob DeGrom giving away too much of what he is to the Nationals. The Nationals don't know yet that Jacob DeGrom is very good, so you can't have him pitch that last game before.
Well, and it's always a thing. It's always a thing with the Mets and the Nationals and Marlins. Because, and especially now, because they play each other so frequently in the spring. They've always played each other frequently in the spring because they've always been on the same coast of Florida. But now, this year, it's just they're only playing four other teams. And that was always just kind of that thing. You know, like, oh, we don't want to show too much to the Nationals or the Marlins because we're going to inevitably see them in the first couple of weeks of the season. And sure enough, they've got the Nationals and Marlins, I think, pretty early in the year. The Nationals they start with, and then I think the Marlins maybe a couple weeks later.
Yeah, it's Nats, Phillies, Marlins, Phillies, I think is the first four series of the year. So that's, you know, you see the division right away. They don't see the Braves, I think, until mid-May, which is interesting and the exact opposite of what it was supposed to be last year. So, yeah, it's just time where, like, I think the hitters at this point have gotten the at-bats they wanted. You know, the Mets, with a different spring schedule this year, you know, you don't have as many games. And so the buildup was less spaced out than it usually is. You know, it's usually like that first game you're playing a college team or something, and every starter gets one at bat, and you know, 2 days off, and then another at bat.
Jeff Wilbon's kid mysteriously goes 3-for-4. Yeah,
you know, you're used to that part of spring training. We didn't have that this year, so guys, it was just a little bit more. It was a steeper buildup for most players, and I think the position players have reached the point where they're ready. The bullpen guys have reached the point where they're basically ready. It's just the starting pitchers getting that last start in. I think we're on to basically the penultimate start for these guys, with DeGrom going Monday, Stroman on Tuesday of this week, and then start, you know, they'll have the one more over the weekend or early next week before the season starts.
We, on our last show, we did some over-unders with the pitching staff, and you have prepared for me more over-unders, this time in the offensive sector.
Over-under, Ted, how many over-unders have I prepared for you? Seven and a half.
I would say, yeah, over. I happen to know the answer is over because I'm looking at them. So we have eight, but we don't know that we'll get it. See, now we don't know. We might have just lied. It might be that might have been a bad bet because we don't know how far we'll get.
Yeah. So what I like to do is email these to you just before we go on so that I am totally prepared for all of them since I made them up and I looked up stuff and you have to answer on the fly.
I'm going with my gut here anyway. I mean, you know what? I guess what it is, I trust you enough to make good over unders. And like, that's the thing is you don't really like if it's a good over under. Then there's really shouldn't be a wrong answer, right? There shouldn't be, oh, he's obviously wrong about this one. Because if you did your job, and I trust that you did, then either call is fair.
Right, like over, under minutes Georgetown would be into it in the NCAA tournament. I would have gone, I wouldn't have set it at like five. I would have set it closer to like 32 or something.
I mean, what a shame it is that they would cancel the NCAA tournament 2 years in a row, you know? Pete Alonso, you have. He is a man who hits home runs, many of them. You have over under 41 home runs.
Yeah, so 41 is, as everyone knows, the old Mets franchise record held by Carlos Beltran and Todd Hundley before Alonso smashed it with 53 in 2019. It was 53, right? I'm not messing that up.
You would know better than I would, but yes, I believe that's the right number. Yes, it is 53.
You know, 54 sounds better, but 53 prime numbers are tough. And Alonso in his quote unquote down season last year, and I shouldn't like it was not as good a season as in 2019, and Alonso was obviously frustrated by it for a large stretch of it, but he still ended it on a 60-game pace that would have meant 43 homers over a full 162. The ball has been supposedly deadened this year. Alonso himself did not think that would affect him greatly, and it probably, I think, when you think about it, would affect the guys who are we generally conceive of as like 20 home run hitters who became 30 home run hitters in the last few years. You know, Francisco Lindor might be the guy on the Mets roster who seems affected by that the most. But it might take a few homers away from Alonso. So I thought 41 was a nice area. Like, will he own the top two seasons in Mets home run history by the end of 2021?
I think, you know what? Over the course of your explanation, it was like a roller coaster for me deciding which direction I was going to go. I want to point out, just because you mentioned his rough season last year, and this is just to sort of reiterate how small of a sample it was. Last season, over his final six games of the season, Alonso added 100 points to his OPS because they just hadn't played that many games. And also because he went 10 for 20 with four home runs. And so, like, I feel like that's just not a good, right? Like, maybe if you gave Pete Alonso another week, he stays hot. And then you look at his season line, and it's not a down year at all. It's just when you're playing so few games, it's not a full season. I mean, it's you know this. I don't know why I'm telling you this. I think he's going to go over. I think he's going to hit. I think the dead ball will be a factor. I think home runs will be down. I think they have to be. I don't think they're going to. It's going to go back to like 1918. And I don't think Pete Alonso is going to stop being like a dude who hits monster home runs. So I think he's going to hit 43 home runs.
Yeah, I think even when Alonso has struggled, and last year being a case in point, and you know, you go back to 2019, that stretch after the All-Star game for you know, a good 2.5 weeks in July, maybe even longer than that. I forget some intimate details of the 2019 season for some reason. You know, it's other things have happened since then. But even when he's struggled, he hits home runs. I remember that stretch in July, even when he wasn't going well at the plate, he hit some big home runs. I seem to remember one in San Francisco in an extra inning game that they managed to lose anyway. Like his struggles are more in a strikeout on base percentage batting average area. The slugging is still kind of there. And so I think he's the type of guy who even in a bad season for him is still going to get to the, you know, 40-ish home runs. So I will go over. He's looked very good in spring training. you know, doesn't necessarily mean he's going to have a great year, but it's better than nothing. And so I can see him kind of hitting the ground running out of camp and just kind of going with it.
Brandon Nimmo, you're giving me on base percentage over under 400.
He's been over it two of the last 3 years at 404 in both 2018 and 2020. He was down to 375 in 2019. Which we all remember from the start of that season when he looked about as lost as you can as a major league hitter at the plate, when it just seemed like he was striking out every at-bat. But over the last 3 years now, that's a significant sample of an on-base percentage of 397, which is really good. 400 is very difficult to get to. I would still think I'm probably going to take the under here because 400 is so hard to get to. I think I am on the strong side of the Brandon Nimmo projections. I think Brandon Nimmo is a really good offensive player, really valuable one, that Mets fans, even the ones who believe he's more than a fourth outfielder, tend to underrate. But I don't think he'll get quite to four. I think he'll be close, but I don't think he'll get quite to 400.
Are there people who think he's a fourth outfielder?
There's still people on Twitter who say that, but there are people... There are people on Twitter who say anything, really.
It's so. Like a rule for the internet, right? Like any the dumbest. I mean, you know, there are people who have made fortunes in sports media saying that LeBron James is bad at basketball, right? So you can find certainly someone on Twitter who thinks Brandon Nimmo is not a fourth outfielder. Brandon Nimmo is like an all-star caliber offensive player, right? He has a career 130 OPS plus. That's really, really good. I agree with every single thing you said. I also think he's a really good offensive player. I also don't think he'll get to 400. I just think it's a high number to expect someone to be at 3 out of 4 years. I could see 390. Like that's his career mark. I don't know like that he's improving at this point. I think he's going to be 28. So I'll say he's under, but he's still really good.
And then the next one, Jeff McNeil, batting average over under of 315, which is, I believe, his career batting average. I should have brought this up. I believe it's 319. Don't want to shortchange him. It's 319. It's gotten down each year, 329 in 18, 318 in 2019, and 311 last year. But a guy who can pretty consistently hit easily above 300. Do you think he'll be, I mean, 315 can put you right in the running for a batting title over a full season these days. Do you have the over or under on that?
I'm going to go ahead and take the over on this. I'm looking at McNeil's stats. It's been remarkably consistent. He has been, and I feel like there's, you know, and DeGrom suffered from this a little bit too. I feel like there's, for as much as there is that prospect sheen that lasts on guys when you're just like, maybe this is the year Delman Young puts it all together. There is also like the non-prospect stigma that I think just gets hung on guys. And as much as I think it's stupid, I find myself doing it too. So you're like, really? Is Jeff McNeil gonna really keep doing this? It's like, why not? Right? Like he hit all the way up through the minors. He was an all-star. He you know, like he's been an excellent offensive player for the entirety of his time in the major leagues, which is now like close to two full seasons worth. I say over. I say Jeff McNeil takes advantage of the deadened ball and sprays it all over the park and hits 325 and wins the batting title. How about that?
I think one of the most interesting, you know, I like diving into the rabbit holes on Baseball Reference, one of my favorite like individual season splits is McNeil's from 2019, his first half versus his second half. Like the OPS is essentially the same. It was 917 in the first half, 914 in the second half, but the way he got there was so drastically different. Like mm-hmm. He hit 349 in the first half of the season and 276 in the second half, but he hit 7 homers in the first half and 16 in the second half in fewer games. You know, it was 7 homers in 76 games versus 16 homers in 57 games. And McNeil himself has said, like, you know, I and others have asked him about, like, whether he was trying to hit for more power consciously. And he said, no, it just kind of weirdly happened that way. So I think that's an interesting debate to have. Like, this is the old, like, Wade Boggs or Ichiro debate. Like, they could hit for power if they wanted to, but they wanted instead to hit for ridiculously high averages. And I think McNeil is the kind of guy who prefers to hit for the average. And like we're talking about with the dead in baseball, probably mitigates some of the desire to hit for power.
Right. McNeil seems like a guy, like you mentioned Lindor. McNeil seems like another guy where, like, I don't know, if the ball's really deadened, I don't know that he's a 23 home run guy. Right. He had 23 home runs in 2019. I don't think you're going to see 20 out of him if the ball's actually deadened.
And I mean, like, the 16 that he hit in the second half, that's like a 45 homer pace for a full season. I don't think we're going to see that. So I think he's always struck me as a guy who wants to hit for average more than anything else. So I will go over, but I think it's close. 315 is awfully hard to hit for these days when you're facing a bunch of different pitchers. And I'm interested in kind of where he hits in the lineup, how that affects what late inning relievers he sees, and whether he hits lefties the way that he has so far in his career, because he's done a really good job against them so far, which is always impressive for a young hitter, that he's earned the trust against lefties right off the bat. He's got a 303 average against them so far.
And how wild is it for the Mets offense that we have just, in Nimmo and McNeil, we were talking about two guys with career OPS pluses over 130 who are in their late 20s, like still prime players, and neither would you say is anything like the focal point of the Mets offense, right? Those are both supporting members of the Mets offense, and I think guys who are good enough to be, you know, to be looked at as way more than that.
Yeah, it was interesting when I tried to put together like how the Mets should construct their batting order. In general, when I would do that in the past, you know, you kind of have, here's the 1 through 8 or 1 through 9, depending on whether there's a designated hitter, the list. And then on the other side of the ledger, you've got basically the hitters ranked 1 through 9 and how good they are as hitters. And with the Mets, it's hard to do that ranking. Like you've got, I think you've got the top 6 guys are all... you've kind of got a group of elite six batters. JD Davis and James McCann are probably a step below. Not that they're bad by any stretch of the imagination. If Davis is what he was in 2019, that's a great offensive player. If McCann is what he's been the last 2 years, that's a really good offensive player. But those other six kind of have a higher ceiling. And you can order them. Like, I can buy that Francisco Lindor is deep down the Mets' best hitter. Like, if he has the best offensive season on the Mets this year, not a surprise. If he has the sixth best, not a surprise. Like any one of those six guys having the best offensive year for the Mets would not surprise me. I think McNeil might be the best all-around offensive player that they have. I'm interested in seeing how his power plays this year.
You think better than Conforto?
I think so, because I think Conforto, you can... There are ways to get him out a little bit more than McNeil, I think. And it really just comes down to like your preference of a hitter. You know, like Conforto is going to hit for more power. He's going to drive in more runs pretty much, based on where he hits as well. But he's going to ground into more double plays. He's going to strike out a little bit more. He's not going to put the ball in play the same level as McNeil. He'll walk more than McNeil. Like, it's there. This is the kind of stuff that you're parsing when you're trying to rank these guys.
Right.
And so eventually when I was putting the batting order together, I'm like, it's basically just how you want to set your righties and lefties. Because Nimmo leading off is I think, the obvious answer there. And then the next five spots, you can kind of just jumble any way you want to, and it's going to be a pretty good lineup.
Yeah, it's something I'm excited about, needless to say. Dominic Smith over under 39.5 doubles.
Yeah, like this is a huge number.
Didn't someone hit a psychotic amount of doubles a couple years ago, like within the last 2 years?
I'd have to look up. I know the Mets team record I looked up is, I believe, 44 from Bernard Gilkey in his great 1996 season. Mm-hmm. You know, there are always guys. I think it was Manny Machado in Baltimore early in his career was on like an insane.
Oh, I think it was just that Freddie Freeman hit 23 last season.
Which is
like a pace for like 50 something or whatever.
Smith hit 21, and that was a pace for 56, which would crush the Mets mark for doubles in a year and be like the most since World War II, essentially.
Since guys were playing on fields with like no center field wall, and so they would just hit lots of doubles.
So I think the guys get on like really good paces for doubles over the course of a month or 2 months or half a season. They never really sustain it.
Oh, yeah. Nick Castellanos 2 years ago hit 58 doubles.
Really? That is a crazy number. Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
In 2019. I knew that there was I was just lingering around in my head that someone hit a ton of doubles recently.
A deep drive to left off the wall by Castellanos. Yeah,
right.
So I think, you know, 39 and a half is high. Like, I would take the under on this, but I think the case for the over is that he had a lot of doubles last year. He's always been a doubles type hitter that was going to get to his power as he matured. And Citi Field plays well for his doubles power, especially gap to gap. He's less a guy who's going to drive. He's not going to be the Chase Utley driving home runs down the right field line at Citi Field over and over, or even Daniel Murphy when he did that for a stretch. And the deadened baseball means maybe a few more of those gappers are off the wall instead of over the wall. So I think there's a case to be made he can get 40 plus, but I probably would take the under still.
I'm going to take the under, and I think, you know, I might be allowing my personal feelings toward the player to color my analysis here. I feel like Dominic Smith is going to hit 75 home runs this year, and so there's just not going to be a lot of space for doubles. You know, like, there's just, you can only hit so many doubles if you're homering like once every three or four times as you come to the plate. Guys are going to start walking them, you know. So, like, if he's going to shatter Barry Bonds' home run record, then I just don't see how he gets to 40 doubles, you know. And so I don't think he gets there. Under.
True. Yeah, I think, you know, I would have taken the under on the 73 and a half home runs for Dominic Smith, but you make a compelling case.
Yeah. He seems really cool. I'd like to see him hit 75 home runs. I think that would be fun. That's something I'm rooting for this year. Francisco Lindor, slugging over under 482, which is, a really good mark for a shortstop, a very good mark for anybody, but it's not like a spectacular. I think you think of 500 as sort of like the 300, 400, the 300 at batting average, the 400 on base percentage, the 500 slugging.
Yeah, like slugging percentage, and I was actually going to ask you how you feel about it as a stat, because it's one that, even as I've covered the sport for a while, I don't know offhand what a good slugging, if you say like, oh, this guy slugs 460, be like, that's pretty good. Okay, it's decent, but like, I don't know, yeah. you know what 260 hitter means. Kind of know what 340 on base percentage means for guys. Slugging, I feel like I still don't have like a firm grasp on the differences between a guy who slugs 430 and 460.
Yeah, and I feel like it's something that I almost would never use in isolation. You know, it's like it's always the third, you know, item in the slash line. But I don't know that I'm ever like, what's this guy gonna slug this year? Other than in this particular context, right?
Thank you for criticizing question in a very kind way.
No offense. I think it's a fascinating over-under to consider.
It's funny you mentioned that, because like, when I write out how a guy did in a season, like if I'm writing a story, I'll write, you know, he hit, you know, this is what Lindor's line was last year. Like, he hit 258 with a 335 on base percentage and a 750 OPS. Like, I will slide entirely past slugging.
But you can do the math. You can do the math, right? Like, you're leaving, all the information is there. But I will say, and this is something, I forget who brought this up because it was, I think I know. I think it was this guy, John Peterson, who used to run a Mets blog. This is way, way back, like early Mets blog days. There was a guy who ran a Mets blog called Blasting's Thrillage. And he pointed out accurately that I'm pretty sure this was his point. If not, I'll credit him anyway. It was a good Mets blog. That he hit. You can say he hit 258, and as a writer, like that is such an easy way to express a player's batting average. But then you have to say with a 335 on base percentage, which is like so much wordier. So like, if there were some way to just say like he based 335 last year, or whatever you want to, like, whatever, not based, because that has like all sorts of 1986 Mets connotations. But like, if you had some verb for on base percentage, I think a lot of people would use it, and you get one for slugging, right? Because you can just say he slugged 518 or he slugged 415. But we need that. And this is no one cares about this except people who have written about baseball for a living. Sentences would be a lot cleaner if we could come up with a verb for on-base percentage.
Would have saved so much on the newspaper word count all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, yeah. I remember having to argue with editors, like, to just be able to put OPS apostrophe D, like he OPS'd 750 or something like that.
He slashed, I think sometimes you see people say he slashed that. I think that's pretty good. Like he slashed 258, 335, 415, but it's so insidery. You know, like you need to know what that means. And it doesn't, when you say he hit 258, it like sort of implies what it is. And he slashed, I don't think you get there. I don't know.
Yeah, like I've read, probably not in the last couple of years, but people who had to write, you know, and had an on-base plus slugging percentage of 4 OPS. And like seeing that in like 2019 was like, I think we can move past this. With Lindor, the reason I chose 482, that was his slugging percentage his rookie season. And then he went below it in 2016 when he was still a pretty good hitter. And then well above it, he slugged over 500 from 17 through 19 when he was a 30 home run hitter each year. His slugging percentage across the three seasons was 514. And then it plummeted last year. You know, he had a bad offensive year all around. Still above league average, we should point out, but slugged 415. So I think 482 is kind of in between the down of last year and the high of earlier in his career, slanted more toward the high. But I think it's going to be like right around this area. I think this might be the toughest one for me to actually pick. But I would probably go with like just underneath it. Like it would not surprise me if he, like, I think his home runs are going to be down a bit again, like we talked about with the baseball. Like I think he's probably more a 20 to 25 home run hitter than a 35 to 40 home run hitter the way he was for a couple of years in Cleveland. But I think that'll affect the slugging a bit. Even he could have almost as good a season as he did in Cleveland. Just the ball's going to stay in the ballpark a little bit more.
Yeah, how does Progressive Field play? And I'm putting you on the spot with that because I'm trying to Google it, but I can only reach one arm into my pillow fort here, and so it's going very slowly. Do you know how? Because I just know from standing on the field in Cleveland that it feels tiny. Have you had that experience? Like ever? Yeah. And I guess it's because I'm most accustomed to. But now I've spent a lot of time like around Yankee Stadium as well, and that feels real small. But like, I would say that Progressive Field feels just as small as Yankee Stadium. I know it doesn't play that way, but certainly doesn't feel as anywhere near as expansive as Citi Field.
Right. So I looked up the park factors. Last year it was a 107 for hitters. So I guess 7% better than the average park. And is a 104 over the last, the multi-year, I think it's 3 years that they do the baseball references, the park factors over. Lindor is a switch hitter, so I guess we don't really have to care too deeply about left field versus right field. I've always felt like Progressive Field plays better for righties with the that shorter wall and left. Citi Field last year played as a 98, so 2% easier, or 2% harder for hitters than the average park, and is a 94 over several years. So, I mean, basically 10 percentage points in the other direction from Progressive Field. So that will have an impact as well.
So I think even if the ball wasn't deadened, I might take the under on 482. And so with knowing that the ball is not going to be as lively, no matter how much less lively it is, I feel comfortable taking the under on this one.
Yeah, like I think Lindor is a very good hitter, he's in a lineup now where he's not the obvious best hitter, which is, I guess in Cleveland he had Jose, it was him and Jose Ramirez were carrying that lineup for so many years, and now he's got a lot of other guys there. I can see him having the best season of anyone on the Mets, even just offensively, but I also see some people kind of dismissing him as the sixth best hitter on this team. I think he's better than that, and I think he's, we can't just look at him as an offensive player when you're trying to decide whether he's worth, say, $300 million, just to throw a number out there.
Right. Well, I mean, that, the guy is a... that's because I think that, like, it's Mets fans have been like, it's been so long since they've had a plus defensive shortstop for a long term, right, that it's like no one even knows how valuable that is. But he is a good defensive shortstop, and he will be for a while, and that is worth a whole lot.
Right. Like, it's just, I mean, just having a guy who can play shortstop the way he does defensively and be an average offensive player is really valuable. You know, he was on pace to be like, I think, a 4.5 win player last year, according to Fangraphs, even when his OPS plus was 102. So if he gets that back to the 120 range that it's been in for stretches of his career, then it's that's what makes him an MVP caliber player.
Mm-hmm. Good. We're on the same page on this one. Michael Conforto, RBIs. Come on. Oh, what is this? Are we doing this in 2004, Tim? We're talking about RBIs. It's over under 100. Under. Over. Because he's going to... where's he hitting vis-a-vis Dominic Smith? Right? Because if he's hitting after Smith, Smith's driving everyone in because he's going to hit 75 home runs. Right? So there's not going to be a lot of guys on base for Conforto unless it becomes like a Barry Bonds thing and all of a sudden Dominic Smith's got like a 609 on base percentage. Then you got to feel like Conforto gets to like 130.
I like the idea that potentially Dominic Smith is hitting 75 home runs, but like not moving up in the order. Like he's still hitting six late in the season.
I think gotta go with what works.
He's comfortable there. And like, where would you hit him eventually if he's doing that? Like, you know, Bonds hit third all the time, but there is a part of you that's like, maybe you should just hit him second, where a lot of teams hit their best hitters now. You know, RBIs are so dependent.
I think the answer is like anywhere he wants, right? Like you just, like you want to lead off, sure.
RBIs are so dependent on that batting order context. I was trying to like, there's just.
And that makes me think comfortably over, honestly, because I'm assuming, and I haven't looked, I'm assuming that's like not too far off the mark for what you could expect out of Conforto on a normal season. And I just feel like to reiterate that point we made, it's just such a deep lineup. And that's the type of thing that creates RBIs.
Right. Like he got to 92 in 2019. He was at 82 in 2018. Those were with some bigger home run numbers, you know, 28 and 82, 33 and 92. He had the weird year in 2017 where he only drove in 68 despite hitting 27 home runs. I think Curtis Granderson did essentially the same thing. One of those years where he hit like 30 home runs and had 40 RBIs because he was hitting leadoff. You know, it's more a question about the entirety of the lineup and how it works than just Conforto. But 100 is a nice round number that you have to throw out. You know, I'm not going to throw over under 97 RBIs. It's got to be triple digits. And I'm going to say just under again. But like if Michael Conforto drove in 118, it wouldn't surprise me. I just want to see someone have like the Juan Gonzalez year in 98 or 99 when he had like 95 RBIs at the All-Star break. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been a while since we had like an enormous RBI season by anyone.
Well, the offensive juggernaut 2021 Mets might be the team to do that.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep. You heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Don't just ride the index. Seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Number of pitching appearances for position players in 2021. Now, refresh my memory. They're not banning that. There's no rule against this now, or because I remember there was like some weird. You got to keep in mind that after I left my job, there was like a brief sort of dark period for me with baseball where I just wasn't following all that closely. But I remember they made all this thing about like, oh, you can designate how many guys can pitch and not everybody can pitch. But then there are times of the game when those restrictions come off, right? It's like if you're up by four or more, down by four or more, anyone can pitch. I think it's something like that.
Right. I'm trying to trying to look up what it was supposed to be going into last season. My understanding is that these rules are off the board. This is not a rule for this year. Good. But it was the margin had to be at least 6 runs, or it had to be in extra innings.
Okay.
Because you saw in the last full season in 2019, teams were much more aggressive with using position players. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a top of the ninth, down 4 kind of situation.
See, I like that. Players. I don't understand why you can't, like, why can't you do that? It feels like we're moving away from the notion of not two-way players, because Shohei Ohtani's looked incredible in camp, but, you know, because of things like that, and because it seems like the universal DH is certainly coming, not this year, but it's coming. We all know it's coming, that, like, it will be increasingly that pitchers and hitters are just, like, separate aspects of this team and not just like a bunch of baseball players who are at least according to the rules allowed to do whatever. But I really think there's like I thought about it when the Mets signed JD Davis, because if you ever watched JD Davis pitch, he can throw gas. Like, he throws in the low 90s. He pitched in college. He might have struck out the side one time while pitching with the Astros. And like, I just feel like there's value. And not him, because not him now, because now he's your starting third baseman, and that's different. But if you had a bench guy who was, you know, Davis, if he didn't become the starting third baseman, your right-handed bench bat, which is a guy you want to keep around, but not a guy you're necessarily going to use in every game. And he could also pitch once, twice a week and give you like a 7 ERA. There is some value in that, in just not having a better reliever throw those innings. And so it kind of bums me out that we're moving away from that. And I think that someone will pitch. I think there will be a position player pitching this year for the Mets. And I'd like it to be JD Davis, because it's cool when you see guys come in and they actually have a little something.
JD Davis pitched twice for the Astros in 2017. Faced, 7 batters, walked 1, allowed 1 hit, struck out 3. And through 60% strikes, which is always the issue in these mm-hmm. situations. He also pitched in 2018 through an inning and did allow a home run. I'm interested in who he allowed that home run to. Give me a second. I'm looking that up. I think and part of it is just like, it's fun, right? When a position player pitches.
Yeah.
He gave up the home run to Ian Kinsler of the
That's respectable.
Angels at that point. Yeah. You know, it's fun. Like with the Mets, there was Luis Guillorme pitched as a position player recently. Jose Reyes did kind of memorably in, I forget if that was 2018 or 2019, the trade deadline. I think it was 2018, the trade deadline day where they lost by more than they'd ever lost before. And I remember like Paul Sewald in the having to warm up in a 24-4 game or something in the ninth inning just in case and not getting into the game.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, I think every Mets fan has, like, the memory
Desi
of...
Desi Relaford is the one
that is
pops
exactly.
to mind. Desi, really? Because he yes. was throwing gas. Remember, Desi Relaford came in and was throwing, like, 94. And it was at a time when no one did that. And it was like, maybe they should just make this guy pitch. Like, what's so good about... I mean, no offense to him, but, like, what's so good about Desi Relaford, the backup shortstop, that you can't, like, give this guy a little turn on the mound?
That was like the first time you saw some position player pitch and he was really good at it.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, like maybe, yeah, like he could do this more than just today. So I think the rule is probably, you know, it's there is a point of diminishing returns with it, where if a position player is pitching for your team once a week, it loses the novelty.
Well, but I don't need it to be a novelty. I need it to be a strategy, right? Like, I just think that there are times when you could... you don't want to carry a guy on your roster with a 7 ERA, but there are times when you just need an inning, and it doesn't really matter if the guy has a 7 ERA because you have a 5-run lead or whatever it is.
What do you think is the best, like, let's say the Mets threw JD Davis. I assume JD Davis would be the best pitcher they have in their position player group. If they threw him in 20 games this year, 20 innings, what is like the best ERA he could put up for them?
No, if it's 20 innings, he could easily luck into like a 3.5 ERA, right? If it's that short, because we see that happen with reliever. I mean, how many times have you seen a reliever come up in September and look like he's lights out, and then the next year not be able to get a single guy out. You know, like it's just, it's so fickle when they're pitching over, over that short span. But I think, you know, over a long enough time, I want to feel like you're not going to get a position player with better than like 6.5 ERA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds about right. Back to the question, I'll go over also. It's a long season.
Yeah.
It seems like something that will probably happen at some point,
and
but probably
like,
not
and
more than once.
Still a lingering pandemic going on, right? Like any number of things could happen. I mean, hopefully that's not what does it, but like there's always this possibility that like four guys have to sit out on and they don't have time to replace them. Yeah, I don't know. I guess they would not play the game in that case. But I don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty still in the air. And so, yeah, I think someone's going to pitch. We're going to go through this last one fast because it's eight different guys. It's eight part. And this is OPS plus, you have, number of Mets regulars out of eight. Oh, I read this wrong. I didn't actually read this question. Okay. I thought you just wanted over unders on each of these guys. What you are giving me is the OPS pluses of the Mets eight regulars and saying how many will have a better OPS plus in 2021 than in 2020, which is just if you don't know OPS plus well, it's just say shorthand for like general offensive season. Pete Alonso, 123. J.D. Davis was 112 in 2020. Jeff McNeil was 131. Brandon Nimmo was 146. Michael Conforto was 156. Francisco Lindor was 102, which, as you mentioned, was outside of, I guess, his rookie year. It was his career low. James McCann was 144, and Dominic Smith was 169. What do you got for me?
Yeah, so I said, like, basically, how many of these guys do we think will be better in 2021 than they were in a small sample of 2020? I said the over-under at 2.5. I actually have to do the math to figure out what I'm going to answer.
Oh, right. I forgot
here.
That part. I forgot to say
because
two and
I think,
a half,
like,
but,
you
yeah.
look at it was a confusing question, I acknowledge. Like, Lindor at 102, that's a guy you think pretty easily is going to go, I shouldn't say pretty easily, but should be better than that over a full season in 2021. Like, I think he'll be better than, you know, OPS plus is how you compare to the league OPS. So he was 2% better than the league last year. I think he'll be better than that this year.
Yeah, it's scaled like. The way I try to think of it, like if people don't, if you don't have a frame of reference for the scale, something else that's scaled to an average like that is the SATs. So if you think like, right, like a 1000 on the SATs is supposed to be average. So if you think of like Conforto got a 1560 on his SATs last year. And Francisco Lindor got like a 1020, but like really, he's a guy who could score a 1200.
Dom Smith got a 1690. That's incredible.
Yeah, he went off the charts. He was perfect. And yeah.
Yeah, which, so I think like Lindor is a guy who I feel really good about saying would be over what he did last year. Smith at 169. I know, you know, you think he's going to hit 75 home
over,
runs this
way
year.
Way over.
I would.
Going 200.
I would say
he's
probably
going to
be under that. You know, I think James McCann at 144 is probably under. Conforto at 156,
under.
Probably under. Nimmo at 146, probably under. So that's four guys I think you'd say won't be as good as they were in a 60-game sample last year. Doesn't mean they're going to be bad, just not as good.
Three.
Well, Smith, McCann, three. Conforto, Nimmo.
Just McCann, Conforto, Nimmo. Smith's still over 200. sorry. Yes, you're right. That is four guys that you would probably, mathematically, logically speaking, you would say will probably be under. Jeff McNeil's a tough call at 131 because that was actually his career low.
Right, and he's been consistent, like we've talked about. And if, like, I think if you're taking like a dark horse pick to be like an MVP candidate for the Mets this year, like McNeil might be it. It would be a strange MVP candidacy. It would kind of be like the Dustin Pedroia 2008 candidacy where it's just, oh, he's like the best all-around hitter on a really good offense on a team that did really well. He hit enough home runs to be part of this. And you know, he could have really a huge year. I think if someone's going to go pretty much over their career track record, I think McNeil might be the guy. Davis at 112, Alonso at 123. I feel pretty good about those guys being over. Davis, you know, I can see it going both ways. But I like, so in that sense, I think I probably should have set it over under 3.5. Because I think there are three good bets to be over, four good bets to be under, and McNeil is probably the hardest call in there.
Yeah, I'll take the over. I'll say over 2.5. Even amounting that Nimmo, Conforto, McCann probably going down, but I'll go over. I think Alonso gets there. I think Davis maybe. Obviously Dom Smith.
What
and Lindor. Obviously Lindor. Really Lindor.
I'm trying to, what was Barry Bonds' peak OPS plus? It was
was like 258, I want to say.
268.
268
in 2002.
I know that Harper, I think Harper in his crazy year a few years ago was at 199.
198, yeah.
Okay. I know it's going over 200 is like the Ruth Bonds Williams, like that's the rarefied air. There, it's happened, but it doesn't happen often.
Right. And like with Bond, like one of the most fun things about being a sports writer is like hearing conversations in baseball clubhouses about Barry Bonds and guys like really good hitters marveling at what he was able to do from that 2001 to 2004 stretch. Like I remember a few years back, David Ortiz was talking about like how hard it was to get a 400 on base percentage and how that was always his goal was like to get to 400 and how impossible that seemed at times. And I think it was AJ Pierzynski was like, man, I played with Bonds. He had a 500 one and just did it easy.
And he had 600
one. And Ortiz was like, no, man, you can't do 500. That's insane. And we looked it up and I was like, no, actually it was 600. And Pierzynski was like, that was the year I played with him. I didn't know it was 600. That's how absurd it is to contemplate a 600 on base percentage.
I had a time, I don't know why, this has nothing to do with the Mets. It's just something I got to get off my chest because it was a big moment for me in my life. It was a very small moment for Barry Bonds. And the 2014 World Series, I want to say, I did a story. I went and I kayaked in McCovey Cove for a story, which is fun. But I had to get back to do post-game stuff, like more traditional post-game stuff. And I was disgusting. I was covered. I can't get into a kayak without getting myself soaking wet with like weird, gross bay water. And so I was just like squishing water out of my shoes. Could smell myself in the seventh inning, walking through the tunnel at AT&T Park, and like just walking alone in the stadium tunnel toward the press elevator. And someone else walking alone was coming the other way, and like there was actual water like squishing out of like I was leaving wet footprints along the tunnel. And I looked up at the person like in embarrassment to like, why am I like, because I probably looked like I wet my pants. And the person was Barry Bonds. And he nodded at me, and I think he saw my jaw drop. It is so hard to, for someone who has, I don't know, worked in that type of job for a while to still be like starstruck. Barry Bonds was like, I was hit with a steamroller. Like, that's him. That's it. That's the Barry Bonds. And I think he appreciated that I was so blown away by just seeing him, because he was majestic.
As that you was squeezed all over, the water out of your shoes.
Yeah. Oh, and I smelled so bad. Like even going back up there. Yeah. There have been so many times I've wound up in like Major League Baseball press situations when I've just been like physically disgusting. And you know what? Like there's always someone else there like that too. That's the good news. We got one question. We have a few questions, but we have a pretty straightforward one from Aaron. Do you want to tackle this?
Sure. Yeah, let's dive into it.
Aaron wants to know. He says, I feel like many outlets treat Dellin Betances as a lock for the bullpen, yet he has looked dreadful in spring. While spring stats don't typically matter, they are important for measuring physical recovery. Betances appears to be a shadow of the pitcher he was and a liability on the mound. Will his large price tag put him on the roster, or would the Mets be willing to carry a pitcher with more upside? Tim, you are way more qualified than I am to answer this question.
Yeah, so I think Aaron's probably not alone in asking that. I don't think Dellin Betances is guaranteed an opening day roster spot, with the way that he's looked. I don't think it's his finances that make him likely to start the season on the opening day roster. I don't think, like, the Mets are not going to release him at the end of spring training or something like that. They're not going to designate him for assignment. I think what you might see, this is me speculating, I have not heard anything in this direction, is if they don't feel confident with where he is, you might get like the IL stint at the start of the season to just work some things out, to spend a little bit more time down in Port St. Lucie until he mm-hmm. feels better about where his velocity is, because it's been 90 to 91 and even a bit below that at stretches this spring. And, you know, this is a guy who used to throw 98 and you're hoping would throw 94 to 96 the way he did last season at times. So, you know, I can see it wouldn't stun me if there is an IL stint to start the year to get someone else on the roster to maintain some roster flexibility, to give Betances some more time. I don't think this is like a Brad Brock situation where the Mets moved on from him even before spring training because they didn't think they had a role for him longer term, even though they had guaranteed $2 million to him. So Betances, I believe it's $6.8 million is his salary. I think they're, like, if you're asking me if Dylan Betances is guaranteed a roster spot all season, no. You know, it him and Familia both could be guys that if they don't perform well, could be moved on from at some point this season with the Mets eating the rest of their money. I don't think they're in a position now to do that. I think you want to give Betances more of a chance to see what he was able to work on in the offseason, see what he looks like when he's a bit healthier. It's hard to do when you've got two of those guys in your bullpen in Betances and Familia. That limits, you know, it's a lot easier if you're carrying seven guys you trust a little bit more and one guy who's trying to work on things. It's harder when it's 6-2. And also, I don't know that there is someone that is so can't miss in the Mets bullpen race in that group of candidates for the last spot. Like, it's not like they're guys knocking down the door that need to be on the opening day roster and Dylan Betances is standing in their way at this point. You know, it's guys like Jacob Barnes, it's Mike Montgomery, it's Tommy Hunter, it's Robert Gazelman, who's got options anyway. I don't think you're going to move on from Dylan Betances permanently just to make room for one of those guys.
Yeah, and I think you don't, it's not about Betances, how much money he's going to make this year. It's about what got him paid in the first place, right? It's because you have to assume that Sandy Alderson certainly and Steve Cohen are better at understanding, you know, sunk cost than certainly many GMs in baseball's past. But I would just feel like, you know, this guy's, and it's a few years now, but a few years ago this guy was the best reliever in baseball, and. That's in there somewhere. Whether it can ever come out again, whether the body will permit it again, is a different question. But I think it's tough to cut bait on someone like that when you know there is that upside there somewhere.
And I shouldn't pretend like I know everything with this front office, because like their timing in releasing Brock surprised me. I thought that was someone that we would be having mm-hmm. this conversation about right now rather than before spring training started. So they've been aggressive in that regard once before in this area, but I don't think Betances, I think because of who he has been, you know, not that long ago in the past, and because of the reasons he struggled in the past couple of years being completely physically related, I think you give him a little bit more of a runway or an on-ramp onto the season to see what he can do. So even if he's not on the opening day roster, you're not cutting him or anything in my mind.
We are out of runway here on the Metrospective podcast for this week. So we should wrap up, and I will say, please do send us your emails. We are you can get at me at asktedberg@gmail.com. You can tweet at me at OGTedberg. You can tweet at Tim at Tim Britton. Rate us and review us on iTunes, please. We love seeing the feedback. Tim, next week, we're going to be looking forward to opening day.
And now everyone's an hour closer to opening day.
Oh, thank heaven. Thank heaven. Tim, thank you so much, and peace out.
Adios.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.